Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Capital Construction, June 9th, 2017. And I'm going to open a work session for the Department of Administrative Services. Amanda.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. The Department of Administrative Services is statutorily required to report to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means the amount of incurred expenses and debt service savings as a result of refunding bonds. DAS completed a refunding in May, and they are here to report on that.
Okay. Jean Gabriel and Patrick Keith.
Co-Chair Gerard, Co-Chair Holby, members of the committee. I'm Jean Gabriel, Capital Finance and Planning Manager with the Department of Administrative Services, Chief Financial Office. Together with the Treasurer's Office, we periodically look for opportunities to refinance outstanding debt in order to achieve debt service savings. We're required by law to report on those savings, so today I'm here to report on a refinancing of outstanding Article 11G bonds. As part of our May 3rd, 2017 issuance of Article 11G bonds, we used a portion of the proceeds to pay off higher interest bonds. This refinancing resulted in general fund debt service savings of $1,925,696 for the 17-19 biennium and total savings of approximately $11.8 million over the life of the bonds. The only agency impacted by these savings is the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, as noted in the letter that we submitted. I would be happy to address any questions you may have.
Any questions, colleagues? Okay, Patrick.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Gerard, Co-Chair Holby, members of the committee. I'm Patrick Heath with the Chief Financial Office, and we recommend acknowledging receipt of the report.
Thank you.
And
well, go ahead.
And Legislative Fiscal Office recommends acknowledging receipt of the report as well.
Oh, great. Good, we're in agreement. Mr. Co-Chair.
Co-Chair Gerard, I move to acknowledge the receipt of the report.
We have to have a quorum.
Oh, yeah. I'll withdraw that motion for the moment.
Wandering off.
Where'd they go?
Meandering around.
Right.
Okay, we have a motion before us to acknowledge receipt of a report from the Department of Administrative Services.
Mr. Co-Chair, let me restate that motion because I think I may have withdrawn it accidentally.
Oh, okay.
Since we didn't have a quorum. Mr. Co-Chair, I move to adopt or to acknowledge the receipt of the report.
We have a motion to acknowledge receipt of a report from the Department of Administrative Services. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition to this? So moved. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5506.
I'm going to just need a carrier.
I'll carry.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 5506 is the capital construction bill. The bill provides six-year limitation for the state's capital construction projects. Most of the projects included in that bill you've seen before because they are funded through bond proceeds that are authorized in Senate Bill 5505, which you've already heard. There are some projects, though, that are actually funded in cash, and so this gives those agencies the opportunity to present on those projects.
And we have four. We have Paul will carry on the House floor.
We just have to go to four.
Oh, it's just got to go to four.
Just take that.
Okay, Paul Mathers.
And you can run them in any order you want. Any order you want. You do what you want with your floor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator, here to testify on the ODOT. Maintenance facilities located within the House Bill 5506. ODOT has hundreds of maintenance facilities around the state that are critical to road maintenance, incident response, and wind or weather. Our site for the Central Coast is located just south of Newport at Ona Beach and is right adjacent to the state Ona Beach State Park. We have entered into agreement with State Parks on a 10-year lease sale agreement to transfer that property to State Parks. In the meanwhile, we have worked with the Department of Forestry to locate a piece of property outside of the tsunami inundation zone that would be better suited for our operations. We've been working with them to locate a piece of property in the Newport, Toledo area. This $6.3 million would allow us to secure that site, do site development, and potentially some construction on that site for our facilities.
Any questions, colleagues? I have one. How many acres are you going to need, Paul?
Mr. Chair, we haven't decided that completely. We've been working with forestry, but it'll be a sizable site given the needs that we'll have at that site as well as Department of Forestry. The Department of Forestry has some ability through their process, forest land contacts, that we think we have some lines on some pieces of property that will qualify for size as well as being outside the tsunami inundation zone.
Okay, Elkins.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins with the Oregon Hunters Association. I'm here today to specifically support Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Ruby Pipeline Timeline Extension to June 30, 2019 for expenditure of funds. This can be found on page 4, lines 16 to 20 of Senate Bill 5506. The Ruby Pipeline funds were the result of a mitigation settlement for construction impacts, including obligation for acquisitions to benefit wildlife species and habitat. Some of the money was used for the new property as part of Lower Deschutes Wildlife Area, which includes opportunities for strategy habitats for fish and wildlife. The request to extend the expiration date of the agreement will allow the department to continue to utilize the obligation mitigation dollars, which is approximately $840,000 remaining. That concludes my testimony. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions? Thank you so much, Adam.
Thank you.
Okay, Joe O'Leary and Rex Emery, considering the Oregon Youth Authority.
Co-chairs, members of the subcommittee, good afternoon. Joe O'Leary, Deputy Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. With me is Rex Emery, our facilities manager. We're here in support of Senate Bill 5506. This bill includes the second installment for OYA's 10-year facilities plan to resolve deferred maintenance and make capital improvements to our physical environments at OYA. We were directed in 2013 to develop a 10-year facilities plan by the legislature. You funded the first installment of that plan in 2015, and those of you that have visited our campuses, particularly our campus at McLaren and at Rogue Valley, have seen firsthand the dramatic transformation that is underway. Continuation of this effort with the bonding provided in this bill will allow us to transform more of our physical environments to be less correctional in nature and more consistent with the developmental approach to juvenile justice, which will mean enhanced public safety and positive outcomes for youth. It'll simultaneously allow us to resolve a great deal of our deferred maintenance. This is a really big deal for OYA, for our kids and for our staff and for the families of our kids. We thank you for your support and urge you to pass Senate Bill 5506.
Go ahead.
I brought Mr. Emery in case you had
in case
detailed
there's a question.
Questions. But.
Questions, colleagues? I have one. It's a pretty sizable. You're asking $50 million, is that?
Co-Chair Garrod, that is correct.
Okay. All right, thank you so much. Okay, Katie Koba with DAS.
Good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chair and members. Katie Koba, Department of Administrative Services. I'm here to speak briefly on the first line item that's included in Senate Bill 5506, which is a little bit over $9.3 million to fund the design and planning work on a new mission-critical building that would be located on the yellow lot and a parking facility that would also be constructed on the red lot. Representative Smith will remember that we spoke to this in our budget hearing in front of his committee, and it was two of the key priorities that I had identified in our budget. The funding for this design and planning work would come from the uniform rent rate that DAS collects for rent assessments on all state agencies. This is really the key first piece in a puzzle, if you will, in terms of renovating facilities on the Capitol Mall to be seismically retrofitted. This building would be a one-of-a-kind building in the state of Oregon in that it would be completely self-sufficient in case of a Cascadia event. And part of the parking structure facility on the red lot would house fuel that would serve the building, but it would be able to work off the grid in terms of electricity and water supplies. I also testified earlier this session in front of the Senate Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee and talked about the importance of working with legislative administration as the legislative and executive branch, I think, can work closely together in terms of being prepared for a Cascadia event and how government would continue to run in the face of that kind of emergency. So very quickly, just wanted to mention that and happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions for Katie? Boy, everybody's getting off easy today.
I actually have one.
Oh, do you? Co-chair Colby.
I heard a little bit about this project. Sounds like a smart thing to do. And while you're upgrading other buildings, that particular agency would be housed there. At the end of upgrading all the agency buildings, who would be housing this at the end of the day?
Co-Chair Holvey, our time span for getting all that work done is probably about 20 years, if I had to guess. So at that point in time, I think we'd circle back and see where we are in terms of state agency needs and occupancy and who should be located where. But we're a ways out from being
making
in that place.
Yes. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And colleagues, I apologize. I completely blew it. I should have been listening in. Instead, I was reading. Can I get an explanation once again on that Oregon Youth Authority, $50 million? Sorry, wrong
Mr. Representative Smith.
I know. Well, I thought you were done. Sorry. I'm sorry, Katie.
And I'm happy to leave.
I wanted to hear your explanation.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Sorry, I should have been paying attention.
Okay. You want to come back?
Just very briefly.
No worries. Good afternoon again. For the record, Joe O'Leary, Deputy Director of Oregon Youth Authority, co-chairs Representative Smith. At a high level, it's a lot of Rex is here to answer specific questions, but at a high level, it is a lot of deferred maintenance.
On multiple facilities.
On multiple sites. And you'll recall the last installment built the new cottages on East Campus of McLaren. This next installment will do the full renovations, including seismic upgrades of the front campus at McLaren. It will also do major living unit modifications at the Rogue Valley Youth Correctional Facility in Grants Pass to make those less detention-like and more residential living. That's a very, very high level of what this will do.
And that's perfect. Can I do a follow-up, Mr. Kutcher?
Yes, go for it.
Are any of those dollars heading to Astoria in any part of an exchange or anything?
Thank you for that question, co-chairs and Representative Smith. With respect to the bonding, no. In the original version of the 10-year plan, we did identify deferred maintenance costs for the North Coast facility in Warrenton. Because our expectation is based on the governor's budget and how things are going in the legislative process, our expectation is the North Coast facility is going to close. So we've not identified any of those deferred maintenance needs for North Coast in this ask, and we wouldn't be investing any dollars that way. In full disclosure and answer to your question, there is a conversation that is occurring, I understand, among members about whether or not the disposition of the North Coast property would be transferred to Columbia County. They are interested in potentially using the property as a jail, and they, you know, it's right next door to the sheriff's office, and they are interested in state funding to help subsidize the modifications that would be needed to convert the facility
but
into a jail.
These dollars are not being used for
my understanding is that none of these would be affiliated with that.
Perfect. That's where I was trying to go, Mr. Kutcher. Okay. Thank you very much.
Great.
Joe, thank you.
done here. I just want to get something on the record.
Sure.
I just want to get this on the record, just so the record doesn't. In terms of your the excellent work your agency did in terms of long-term plans for capital need, it wasn't simply that the governor didn't put Warrington into her budget. It was that you don't believe you need that capacity in the foreseeable future.
Co-chairs and Senator Devlin, thank you for that question. And yeah, for the record, if I led you to believe that was the reason, no, I didn't mean that. The truth is our close custody capacity is down significantly. It was down in 2013 when we put forth the 10-year plan that called for the consolidation of Hillcrest and McLaren. That was part of the reasoning. And when we looked at our close custody portfolio across the state and we saw the likelihood of reductions coming in this cycle, we looked at that portfolio with respect to which facility would make sense to close if we were in a position to close another facility. And North Coast made the most sense for a variety of reasons.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Okay, I'm going to close. Does anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 5506? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5506, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1067.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Senate Bill 1067 does a number of things, including establishes new requirements for budget development, both for the governor's proposed process and the legislative budget process. It requires additional legislative review for executive branch actions. It makes changes in key areas of the budget, including PERS, debt issuance and practices, and PEB and OEBB administration and costs. Actions in the measure are designed to restrict future growth and costs and to implement prudent financial practices. In addition, where feasible, these practices are being instituted in the current budget process, including the elimination of long-term vacant positions and associated funding, reducing standard inflation, and slowing down and restricting hiring in 2017-19. These actions result in savings in the budget and in many cases resets the base to reduce future costs. With that, I will do a quick section-by-section overview of the measure. Section 1 is regarding the review of reclassifications, and it requires the Department of Administrative Services to submit quarterly reports to the legislature on reclassification of state positions so that the legislature can take those into account when determining budgets and other actions. Section 2 is the review of long-term vacancies, and it requires DAS, the Department of Administrative Services, to submit annual reports to the Legislative Fiscal Officer regarding positions that have been vacant for 6 months or more. LFO is then to review the report and make recommendations to the legislature regarding adjustments to agency position authority and funding. Section 3 is the report on collective bargaining roll-up costs and addition of steps and ranges. And currently, DAS does come in and report on compensation plans, but this includes these additional pieces, including proposed changes to step pay increases, cost of living adjustments, and any change that has an economic effect on a salary plan. They also must estimate the future full biennial cost of such changes. Sections 4 and 5 adjust the cap on state government employment. It is currently at 1.5% of the population and reduces it to 1% of the population. Section 6 requires LFO to conduct a study prior to each odd-numbered year session on the Lottery Commission's administrative costs and transfer rate to determine the appropriate transfer of funds for budget purposes. Section 7 requires a study to be conducted on current procurement practices, including current statutory exemptions to DAS procurement authority to determine if improvements can be made to save money. In this case, it is possible that the Secretary of State may conduct an audit. If that's the case, that would be what would be the report to the legislature that we would have. If that doesn't happen, it instructs the Legislative Policy and Research Office to conduct that study. Section 8 is regarding utilizing cost information in state budget development, and it authorizes the Legislative Fiscal Office to review an updated projected current service level costs for the legislative budget process from those that are used for the governor's recommended budget preparation. Section 9 requires the governor's budget to include at least 2% of the current replacement value of state buildings and infrastructure for deferred maintenance. Section 10 requires the governor's budget to include recommendations regarding the ability to establish employer side accounts to help offset future PERS costs. Section 11 reduces the PERS contingency reserve account and caps that account at $50 million. Section 12 ensures that official reporting by the PERS board and staff of the PERS unfunded accrued liability shall also include information regarding the value of side accounts. Sections 13 and 14 regarding state borrowing and requires the legislature to set a minimum project amount for bonding. Projects approved under that amount would be paid for with cash rather than with bonds for small projects. It also prohibits bonding for ongoing state administrative operating expenses. Sections 15 to 24 regard debt collection practices and centralizes state debt collection work and requires agencies to assign specified liquidated debt to the Department of Revenue for collection. This language is from Senate Bill 89, if it looks familiar. Sections 25 through 26 requires a plan to be developed for the merger of the Public Employee Benefits Board, PEB, and the Oregon Educators Benefit Board. It also begins administrative consolidation. Sections 27 to 28 require PEB and OEBB to use payment methodologies and to adopt policies and practices that limit health services costs to 3.4% growth each year. Section 29 through 34, ties rates for hospital services provided through PEB and OEBB to a percentage of Medicare rates. Section 35 is related to captions, and then Section 36 is an emergency clause.
Okay, any questions for staff before we get started? We have a good representative out there, Representative Gomberg. Would you wish to come testify?
Thank you very much, co-chairs and members of the committee. Good afternoon. For your record, I'm David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon coast, and I'm pleased to be with you today to speak briefly to the aspect of cost containment that deals with delinquent debt. And I wanted to talk particularly about the Dash 3 amendments that I have offered for you. But just very briefly, a little bit of background. As you know, I'm a small business owner. And when my business needs money, we look at reducing our costs, we look at increasing our revenues or our sales, and we look at our accounts receivable. And what are the accounts receivable for the state of Oregon right now? Colleagues, in excess of $3.3 billion. And despite six audits over the last 10 years, that number has doubled, while the rate of collection is actually declining. And what we're learning are things like the number of people who submit tax returns each year but don't send in a payment or create a payment plan, over $600 million. The number of businesses that owe fines or fees to the state but are hired by other agencies to perform work. So we got money coming out when the money isn't coming back to us, about 9,000 different companies. And the amount of debt that we write off each year, I mean, simply get tired of trying to collect it. This problem is so pervasive that we are now writing off or canceling over $500 million a year in delinquent debt. I wanted to thank Representative Williamson. We have a measure in your Rules Committee trying to address that right now. So as you heard, the measure before you, 1067, includes major portions from Senate Bill 89. And one of the main things that 89 would do is take the delinquent debt throughout the state system and consolidate it within the Department of Revenue, where they can cross-match people who owe more than one account. They can focus with some of their special tools to collect that money. They can use their experts to zero in when a lot of agencies don't have such experts. I wanted to give a shout out to Representative Smith and the General Government Committee, who's been working very hard with the Department of Revenue to refine their tools and encourage them to do a better job on all of this. And that background brings me to my Dash 3 amendments, which were intended for Senate Bill 89, but are now before you on 1067, and they say this. They address those agencies that are currently carrying more than $50 million in delinquent debt. And it says three things. It says, first of all, take a look at that debt and tell us what kind of debt it is. Is it uncollected taxes? Is it fees? Is it fines? Is it restitution? Let's characterize the debt so we understand what that money actually constitutes and why it's owed. The second thing it says is take another look at those accounts and tell us which are reasonably collectible. Let's get a sense of how much of the money out there is real, how much of it is not real, or how much of it might be real. And the third thing it says, colleagues, is that those agencies or departments, again, with $50 million or more, need to put a plan together to start collecting on it more efficiently, with a target of 10%. So what does that mean to us in terms of our cost containment goals right here? Because the numbers that have been circulated at this point don't include any revenues generated from debt collection. And I'm going to exclude for a moment any monies that are not general funds. I think there's plenty of good reason to go after those dollars, but let's concentrate on the general fund dollars, which again, out of that $3 billion plus, constitutes about $600 million. So if we can encourage agencies and they can be successful in pursuing 10% of that $700 million a year, that's going to mean another $70 million in cost containment that we can put toward good causes. Colleagues, it's not going to close the fiscal gap that we're facing. It's not going to balance our accounts, but I don't know that that's really the point. The point is that most Oregonians pay their fair share and get frustrated when not everybody does so. So I hope that you'd encourage the Dash 3 amendments as one more tool to make sure that that we're collecting the monies that are owed to us and that everybody is in fact paying their fair share. Mr. Co-Chair, happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Not a question, but a comment. Representative Gomberg has done phenomenal work, thoughtful work on debt collection practices within the state. We collectively would be very wise to follow his leadership on this issue. He's taken the time and the energy to get to know this issue, to research it, to talk with folks within state agencies. And so I applaud you, Representative. And again, I want to reiterate, we would be very, very wise to follow his counsel as he's bringing it forward to us.
Is that a question?
Statement.
Any questions at all? Thank you so much,
Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you for those kind words, Representative. Thank you, committee.
Okay, I'm going to kind of break things up here a little bit. Rob Bovet and Scott Wilkins.
Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm appearing in support of House Bill 1067. Specifically, I would like to draw the committee's attention to Section 10 of the bill on page 7. This section essentially directs the governor to include recommendations on what potential funds could be used to provide lump sum payment under 238.229. That's the side account statute. This is a perfectly wise step. We're supportive of it. But the League and in conjunction with my colleague from AOC, we are seeking an amendment to make these accounts more accessible to all PERS employers. Current law directs PERS to establish A as a singular side account for each lump sum payment. That lump sum payment must be either $1 million or 25% of total UAL for the employer. What the amendment that is currently in the drafting would be is to establish, instead of A payment, one or more separate accounts within the public employee retirement funds for one or more lump sum payments. Essentially, what it would allow us to do is to add money to an existing side account or make it easier to open a new side account for an employer. There are some, we also believe reading that language, that language change would be beneficial to the state as well. PERS is currently undertaking some rulemaking to make these site accounts more accessible to all employers, and this change would give them, and in turn, all PERS employers more accessibility to this program. Mr. Co-Chair, as a member of the committee for the record, Rob Levatt, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties, I'll just say ditto to what my colleague, Mr. Winkles, had to say and let you know that I have crafted the amendments. We've floated them through the PERS staff, and they're now at Legislative Council. We expect them to come out here any day. It does just make those very narrow word changes to make site accounts more usable for all public employers.
Any questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. Okay, I think I'll go to Jeremy Rogers and Tim Nesbitt.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gerard and Co-Chair Holy. My name is Jeremy Rogers with the Oregon Business Council, here to speak mostly about the PEB and OWEB provisions of Senate Bill 1067. First, would like to compliment you on the work that you've done to create this legislation and all of the components of it, and I won't spend much time talking about the other components, but appreciate those and think that they are important to pursue. On the PEB and OWEB component, I'd like to offer some thoughts, and also would like to offer, she was not able to be here today, but Denise Hansel is a healthcare policy consultant for the Oregon Business Council, and she ran the health insurance division at Kaiser for a number of years, and she's been working hard on developing proposals around PEB and OWEB, and would love to make her available to the committee as this bill gets worked. So there's some documents that you have in the record outlining some of our thoughts on PEB and OWEB, and let me just get into those. First, I think it's very appropriate that this issue is being addressed in the cost containment bill. Our research has found, particularly as it relates to PEB, that Oregon, the total premium cost for state employees in Oregon is significantly higher than the national average. In fact, I believe we're the sixth highest total premium cost and like the fifth lowest employee contribution to that premium. Those premiums are 5% or in some cases lower, depending on the plan that's selected. And Oregon is an outlier in that respect. And we think that there is a lot of good provisions in the bill to work off of, including the merger of PEB and OWEB. I think that the goal, though, of the merger really should be to ensure that over time that the costs growth is slowed, and that there is benefit designs, employer-employee contribution strategies, other elements that really help to control costs and that move Oregon closer to what other states have, the costs that have been achieved in other states. We do not believe that the capping of the or the rate setting of 200% of Medicare for provider reimbursements is really the right approach to take in terms of cost control. We think that the reimbursement rate certainly should be looked at as part of an overall strategy to control costs. But we also think that the employee contribution, employer contribution, and the benefit designs and other elements really need to be looked at more closely in the bill as well to get to where we need to go. In the record, we created a sort of side-by-side comparison that has some suggestions on different components of the bill that I hope can be helpful to you. I won't go through all of that, but I will just mention a few things. On the board composition, the current legislation calls for an equal number of PEB and OWEB board members. We think that it also should include healthcare and insurance industry experts, along with labor management and the health authority. In terms of the role and responsibility of the board, in addition to administration and operations, we think that it really should be accountable for creating plan designs, reimbursement strategies, and rating structures, and employee-employer contribution strategies that help to contain costs, that help to encourage employees to choose plans that best meet their needs, that encourage employees to choose lower-cost plans if they do not need higher-cost plans. One of the things with PEB, at a 5% contribution rate, that there's a very little difference in cost to the employee of choosing a lower cost plan and a much higher cost plan. And we think that if you were to move to a defined contribution approach rather than a percentage of premium approach, that would be a more appropriate mechanism to help encourage individuals to choose plans that best meet their needs. And we think if there's a variety of plans that are offered, including those that come in at the employer contribution or below, and then plans also with richer benefits that employees can pay more out of pocket for, that will help to control costs and encourage folks to take plans that best meet their needs, and also avoid issues where you have currently in PEB where because of the 5% cost sharing and the benefit designs, you have and 5% cost sharing for both individual plans and full family coverage plans. We have a lot of individuals that will have their spouse and family covered under a PEB plan when the spouse might be able to achieve, get a health care plan through their own private employer. And a lot of, in the private employer community, a lot of work has been done to try to create structures that encourage individuals not to do that, to put their spouse on the plan if not needed, if they have their own access to a plan. And so I think there's a lot of these things that could be addressed in this legislation if there was just a little more direction given to the goals of the merger and the role of the board in terms of what they're trying to get to in terms of contribution strategies and plan designs. And one of the most important things is that defined contribution. We think that it would be appropriate to cap that contribution at the current level. We found that Oregon, the state employee costs for the employer are about 150% of the U.S. average currently. We think that over time the goal should be to get to some target. Maybe it's 110%, 120% of U.S. average. We think being above average is fine, and I think we do have a slightly higher health care cost here. But we believe there should be some form of goal, and to get there, we think implementing a cap where we're currently at until over time we get closer to that goal would be an appropriate mechanism. Now, in PEB, we're very far from that goal. In OWEB, there's probably some districts that are there already and some that aren't, and so that makes it a little more complicated as you merge the two. But having a goal, moving to defined contribution, and capping, we think is a good strategy. So I'll leave it at that for this piece. And hand it over to Tim. I just would like the committee to know that we've also done a lot of work on PERS and things related to 1068, and we hope that there's an opportunity to testify on that bill as well, and we'd like to come before the committee to do that. And also let you know that we've done a lot of work on other elements of what could be a broader package to balance the budget, make new investments in education that includes cost containment and new revenue, new business tax revenue. Patrick Kreitzer presented some ideas at a joint tax committee last week, and we'd like to be helpful in all of those components. And we have policy consultants like Tim and Denise and others that are happy to help as you continue your work for the rest of the session. And I thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. Go ahead, Tim.
Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt. I've been doing work, as Jeremy told you, on the PERS issue for the Oregon Business Council. I'm going to be very brief because since I submitted my slide deck, which is in the OLA system now, we understand that there'll be a hearing on Senate Bill 1068, and I think my testimony is more appropriate directed to that legislation. I'll just say that you heard from the representative of the League of Cities, we appreciate the provision in Section 10 to allow for more one-time payments to draw down the unfunded liability of the system. We have other ideas for averting employer cost increase over the next decade, which will amount to an increase in payments, state, city, counties, K-12, community colleges, universities, of more than $9 billion over the next 8 years to the PERS system. So that's the concern. We will have more to say at the time we have an opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 1068 and how we can mitigate the impacts of those cost increases and hopefully preserve and expand services as a result.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, sorry I was late. Good to see you. Jeremy and Tim, thanks for being here today. I just want to clarify for the record and for those watching, there's been no agreed-upon scheduled hearing for 1068. It will depend on a correspondingly robust conversation on the revenue side. Look forward to seeing the numbers. You know, we hear a lot about how we should look like our counterparts, or at least the average, when it comes to benefits and compensation and pension. Look forward to talking about how we should be close to average on how our business tax structure supports essential services here in Oregon.
Any other comments or questions? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeremy, I'm not on a health care committee or anything like that. I just kind of hear bits and pieces of conversations. But Sections 25 and 26 call for a merger of PEB and OEP. Have you guys gotten a little more prescriptive as to, I mean, you suggested additional seats at the table in a merged board, but have you got on OLIS or something or in your plan suggestions on how we could, I don't know who's in the room, I don't want to step on toes, but I've heard that OEB maybe has had a better opportunity to control costs and options to their folks. Do you outline some of the recommendations on how the new board should approach business?
Yeah, thank you, co-chairs and Representative Huffman. Yeah, there's two documents on OLIS. One is a two-pager describing our suggestions for how to go about this, and then also a side-by-side. And I think that we do, and our research has found the same thing about OEB has done a better job of controlling costs. And OEB does have a defined contribution approach. And so I think that there are, I certainly want to avoid risks of, you know, merging the two, and we don't want to, you know, screw up good things that have been happening in OEB. But I think the opportunity is to, for the whole system to implement more things that like OEB has done. And I think OEB has areas to improve, and they would, you know, admit that as well. But in the documents of recommendations on board composition, what the sort of roles of the board should be, a transition plan in terms of what that transition team or committee or whatever should focus on and bring back to you, role of the executive director, and then kind of specific roles around how to work on benefit plan designs, on plan benefit designs, on employer-employee contribution strategies, reimbursement strategies, et cetera. So, and as I mentioned, Denise is quite an expert in this, and I'm doing my best, but she's can be available by phone or in person for any members of the committee that want to talk more about the documents and other, and she's continuing to develop those.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was Senator Devlin and I who are two of the members that served on the Cost Containment Committee, and I really want to be clear to everyone. We had no preconceived idea, nor do we have a plan today on the merger of these two boards. What this portion of the bill, Section 25 and 26, talks about is let's look at, is there a way to find benefit for the state of Oregon and for our employees? There, I can assure you behind closed doors, there was never one comment about how we must do it in a way to the detriment of our hardworking state employees. Nor was there any conversation in any way on what the outcome of that plan should be. And so I just want to make sure I'm on record sharing with everyone, it was, let's get the best and brightest minds to the table, let's have a conversation, and let's do it in a way that creates a win-win for everyone. And I just feel compelled to get that on the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeremy, I wanted to follow up on something you said about the benefits. Why don't you like the pegging to Medicare and the cost control?
I think it's arbitrary to peg it 200% of Medicare, and that would likely result in cost shifting to other parts of the system. We certainly think that reimbursement rates should be one of the things that's looked at as the, if a merger continues or this goes on. I think that's fair to look at, but just saying 200% of Medicare and sort of having and not having these other components, I think is it's arbitrary and will result in cost shifting to other parts of the system. And there's so much opportunity in the benefit designs and the contribution strategies to achieve both cost savings and people having plans that meet their needs, that we believe that should be pursued first, and then looking in tandem with looking at the contribution or the the reimbursement strategies.
I appreciate the answer, but I think it's really important when you say cost shifting. I think it's incumbent upon us as the stewards of taxpayer money to get the best contracts we can. Currently, we don't have sufficient price controls on what we pay for services in PEP. And OEB has reference pricing. That's a cost shift as well. They're doing that. And there's a cost shift to the state. We're picking up, we are a bit of a cash cow in the private sector to cover other costs. So, this is an attempt to say, based on a reasonable way to assume what a price should be, we should be getting the best price for our plans. Because as you noted, we have higher health insurance costs than our health services and, say, some of the other states you've studied. So I just want to make sure we're not just talking about price controls, but it cannot just be cost shifting onto the employee. We have to have price controls. Otherwise, we're just, paying for a whole bunch of other people. And that's not a cost control for us at all.
Co-chairs, Representative Kotek, thank you for that. And I'll point out that what we had said in this, you see in the comparison document, was that,
which, by the way, none of that's online yet. So
I apologize.
Looking, it'll get there. I'm
okay.
Just saying.
All right.
We're all looking forward to
that. To look at reimbursement, to look at risk-based contracts, global budgets, and other strategies, and that, capping traditional fee for service, that can be looked at, but that we think there's other strategies as part of reimbursement rates that should be pursued first, rather than just laying a hammer down on the amount at what could be an arbitrary rate to work with the providers in the overall reform effort to try to come up with structures that help control costs and that and that are reasonable on reimbursement. And so I just think it's a process to get to the right answer. But there's other ways to do it other than just capping the reimbursement rate.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Kocher, I want to strongly support Speaker Kotek in the effort she has. Probably 3-4 months ago, her office came to me and just shared this idea with me, and I thought about it and really started looking into this concept. And the state of Oregon has an obligation to negotiate the very best deal for its citizens. And so I think it's extraordinarily reasonable that we would say this is the cap. We're willing, it's the taxpayers' money. We have a fiduciary obligation to manage it. And as a consequence, we have a right to put a limit on there. And so I strongly support that effort, and I think it makes good sense. It's no different than a small business owner negotiating a deal, saying, here's what we need, here's what we're willing to pay.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I'm not an expert in this field, but when we start talking about a, Jeremy calls it an arbitrary cap, I don't know how that number was developed, if it's arbitrary or if there's science behind it, but I'm going to tell you one of my biggest concerns is to make sure that if we're capping the, my rural providers, my rural hospitals, their connections with the CCOs and stuff are not going to be damaged, because I know that Rep. Smith and I have dealt with our rural frontier pharmacies in the past, and they've had to live under a lot of the same rules as the bigger pharmacies in the valley, and it has not worked well under some of the plans that the state's developed. And so as we move forward, I'm going to be looking and supportive, but I just want to make sure that we're not going to be doing damage to rural Oregon in the process.
May I just quickly? I just want to make sure, since we're talking about the bill, I think, Representative Huffman, that's an excellent point. And you probably haven't a chance to look, but in Section 29, it would exempt Type A and Type B hospitals and rural critical access hospitals for this price control, because given payer mix in some of these smaller places, it is an issue. So I think that's an important point. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. We have to move along here a little bit, so since we're on a hot topic here, let's go to Jen Wielander and Maggie Hudson.
Good afternoon, Senator Girard and Representative Hovley and committee members. I'm Jen Wielander. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for St. Charles Health System. So we have the four hospitals in Central Oregon, the largest being in Bend, and Bend is the one that would be covered by Senate Bill 1067. So you have my written testimony. I would like to highlight two key concerns, specifically within Sections 29 through 34 of the bill. So the first is, healthcare, as we know, is on a journey to transform how we make care more affordable and to create value for our patients. So we're doing this as a hospital and a system of providers by starting to be paid for our performance and being put at risk for costs and outcomes for our patients. This bill does single out hospitals, which do represent only approximately a third of the healthcare costs when you look across the continuum. It doesn't look at healthcare holistically, and one of the things that is key to changing the overall affordability of healthcare is to look at providers, behavioral health, dental, and physical health together, because when we come together and we have aligned incentives, we are starting to move the dial. And I think the innovation in the Medicaid program through the CCOs is really showing that, and we have incentives that are aligned both economically and for the outcomes we produce. This cap, as it's currently designed, is really a pure fee-for-service arrangement where we are paid for the volume that we do, and it feels very counter to the transformation activities that the state has been encouraging and that all of us are undertaking. So that's one area of concern for me, is the setback to transformation that this may lead to. The second piece, which really coincides with that, is this question of cost shift. And so, as we all know today, Medicare and Medicaid rates don't cover the current cost of healthcare, and that's why we're on the journey for transformation. In the short term, we do see this as creating a risk of cost shift within a community. PEB and OEB are a significant purchaser of services, as you've identified. So for all of us that do serve your members, when one set of commercial payers changes very dramatically, the initial reaction will be a cost shift, and it's going to be a risk of cost shift to the employers and the other individuals who purchase commercial insurance in our communities. And I think that will have an economic impact to our region. which puts me back to the primary area of concern is we need to continue to transform, and we need to be rewarded for creating better outcomes for your members. So with that, we, on behalf of all the hospitals that are part of the association, we strongly urge the legislature to support Senate Bill 419A, which is the task force that is going to look at payment reform. And we think there are tremendous lessons to be learned from looking at other models, Maryland being one of them, where they have had success in getting to an all-payer rate-setting environment. I appreciate your time.
Speaker Kotick.
Oh, Mr. Chair, you're being so generous. I appreciate it. So thank you for being here. So just to clarify, you would support a Maryland price control system?
I support us looking at an
all-payer.
Okay,
just checking. Just checking. Okay.
I support us looking at payment reform because I think it's absolutely important.
And just to be clear, in Section 29, we make sure that if you're not doing fee-for-service, this should not impact your ability to do value-based payments, capitation payments, and bundled payments. So we're not trying to stifle reimbursement methodologies or innovation in the system. So I want to be clear. I don't think that's the intent. So
let's look. Maggie, would you please testify?
Yes. Good afternoon, Senator Girard and Representative Holvey and the rest of the committee. Thank you for letting us be here today. My name is Maggie Hudson. I am the CFO of Saniam Hospital, which is just 15 miles east of here in Staten. We are a Type B hospital. And I heard some conversation earlier in regard to Type A and B hospitals being protected by this legislation. And I would like to point out that right now we're going through legislation where Type A and B hospitals are getting pulled into a provider tax, and that's the slope that these things will continue to go down. And so as you look at those facilities, it is very detrimental. I would echo what Jen had to say. This is a change that would happen somewhat overnight, and we need to be on a conversation of transformation and allow us more to innovate as opposed to go down this pathway of rate setting arbitrarily. Somebody used the word arbitrarily, and I think that's interesting because Medicare is designed for a population that is ages 65 and over. And so the question is when you apply a payment methodology, how do you account for immunizations and well child checks and pregnancies and other things that Medicare is not designed to affect? So the payment methodology, although it sounds simple, hospital reimbursement is far more complex than that, and arbitrarily assigning that to that may not be the best approach and may be revisited by a more collaborative approach. I'm also on the board of the CCO here locally, Willamette Valley, and we take care of 100,000 lives. And the innovation and the conversations of taking a more innovative approach to how the medical, the dental, the behavioral aspects of care come together is a far healthier conversation in getting us to all cost savings, as opposed to trying to impose a structure in place that will shift initially for everybody and in some instances have huge effects on the health of the hospitals. So I thank you for the opportunity to speak today. We do look forward to a conversation around the Senate Bill 419A and continue the conversation.
Okay, questions for this panel?
I won't bore you anymore.
I would just like to point out there's a big difference between negotiations and a mandate, so that's what bothers me, I think, the most. And just for the record, Saniam Hospital saved my life. I could never have made it to Staten. I went into anaphylactic shock, and they just happened to be there, and so I'm very grateful to Saniam Hospital.
Thank you
so much for your testimony. Mm-hmm.
And, Mr. Chair, I completely agree that we should support our hospitals, and I've mandating what our public benefits and pensions should look like are not being negotiated. So, let's be clear about what we're talking about in mandates and negotiations. So,
okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And I apologize. Someone has driven over 100 miles, and I haven't got to him yet. Freddie Senhausen from All Care Health. And then I'm going to bring up Ben Peterson from Oregon Association of Health Underwriters.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Freddie Senhauser. I represent All Care Health out of Grants Pass. We're a physician-led and physician-owned organization, and I'm here in particular to speak about sections 25 through 34. We feel it would be a very good thing to combine PEB and OEP, and in interest of time, I'll keep my remarks really short. We also believe that this Bill 1067 is very good in terms of cost savings. in particular adopting a Medicare payment methodology and capping the reimbursements that hospitals receive, and specifically because it's not done on the back of the employees, neither the state employees or the teachers. We also feel that by setting this cap in statute, which, by the way, worked really well on the Medicaid side, why not do it on this side, will be very good, and it will encourage competition. We are a very small plan. As you might know, we're CCO, but we're also a PEP contractor, and our local members like it because we are local. We're a local plan. If you create competition with this, you will encourage other smaller organizations, maybe CCOs in other parts of the state, to become part of the delivery system on PEP and OWEB. And lastly, I heard a talk about using a Medicare methodology. I mean, if you put this in perspective on Medicaid, 200%, we're paying 66% or give or take on the for Medicaid, and of course with 200%, we would still pay more than twice what Medicare would pay. So in all, I urge you to approve this bill. Send it out.
Go ahead, please.
Distinguished Committee, thank you. I'm Benjamin Peterson with the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. We represent about 450 brokers throughout the state and then some free riders that are not members. We are speaking about sections 29 through 34 on the cap to hospital payments, and I heard cost shift is not a term you want to hear, but that's kind of what we're going to revisit. And our main standpoint is that there are much better ways to go about curbing the cost. You've seen this result with the CCOs. I was on the Medicaid expansion study for the City Club of Portland, and even Providence's work has reduced the cost of the Bud Clark Commons by almost 50% simply by housing people. So there are other ways to go about assisting with the cost controls without capping the hospital costs. Because if I go into a store and I say, oh, your price is X, and whether X is a great deal or not, I appreciate that we need to negotiate our costs. I do understand that. If that's the cost, I don't say, well, I'm only going to give you $20, pay the $20, and then walk out the door. It just doesn't make sense. So there will be a cost shift, and I've talked with our carriers about this, to the commercial market. And that's the question of who's going to pay it, rather than focus on what we need to do now. And it's a difficult conversation. Do we make decisions now and shift cost? Do we? And I don't have any solutions, but I don't believe that this cost cap is a solution at this time. So we want to go on record in opposition to this section. Thank you.
Any questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay, on deck, I'm going to we'll have SEIU 503, and then right now I'd like to hear from Tim Cowan.
Co-chairs, distinguished committee, for the record, my name is Tim Cowan. Just a couple comments because you have so much on your plate. The first one is I spoke at the annual Bankers Association meeting on problem loan prevention. A couple things that you might want to consider when you talk about it. One, the person has to know how much. The person needs to know what the terms are there to pay. But the biggest issue is the follow-up. How long does it take the person to follow up and let the person know it's to be collected? The one thing I'd love to tell you is for every 3 days of delay costs you 1% of revenue permanently. So whether you're getting the revenue for taxes or whatever, one of the things you should ask people or the people testifying is how much delay has there been from last year to this year? And every 3 days it's permanent. The next item I'd like to talk about real quick is when we talked about cost containment. I think the state employees are great. Everyone I've dealt with are great. They have an idea of where some cost savings can be. And I think that it would be great to have administrators or managers have some type of report that they could solicit from the employees, where can we save money, and then turn that into you. And as a basis of the money they can save, you can just take that and put it against what's due on PERS, and the employees are motivated to come up with those cost savings and give it to the managers and participate in that and get the savings and revenue. Those are my points I'd like to tell you.
Okay, thank you. Any comments or questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, we got Steve Demarest, Sasha Sergeva, Dan Smith, and Melissa Unger.
Co-chairs Gerard and Holby, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Stephen Demarest, and I'm president of SEIU Local 503. I'm here to testify about Senate Bill 1067, which has many different elements, and we want to thank the work group for their hard work on this. Over the years, our members have been very interested in cost containment. I submitted to the committee a report that we made in 2011 about how the state could decrease cost. Some of those ideas have been implemented, and some have not. I also submitted a more recent list of things that should be looked at that came directly from frontline workers. Some of the ideas, such as vacancy savings, are being considered, but many other ideas are not, and we hope that they can also be a part of the conversation. There are parts of SB 1067 that we have a lot of concerns about and other pieces that we think are good ideas. I want to highlight the pieces that we support. One, we think that the costs, or that the idea of capping provider costs for PEB will help to bring down cost. Increasing provider costs is the main driver of cost increases for PEB, and so a cap would help contain those costs. We like to focus on debt collection. This has been an ongoing issue for the state, and it's time that we address the issue and bring in more of the money owed to Oregon. Three, we also like the review of contracting. In the report I submitted from 2011, we highlighted the cost of IT contracting in particular. We believe there's a lot of waste in state contracting, and for IT in particular, there's a lot of savings available. There's other elements of the bill and the budget that we do have concerns with. This bill has been linked to many different budget items that are being discussed as well, so we are addressing the budget cost containment items like the hiring slowdown as well as the elements of this bill. One, we have a lot of concerns about the hiring slowdown that has been talked about in relation to cost containment in this bill. Right now, many departments are facing higher than average retirements. We can expect that to happen this year, and having a slowdown in hiring could cause major disruptions in delivering the services people need. Two, we oppose the lowering of the cap on FTEs. We understand that the current level may not be something that is limiting employment, but we also don't understand why the cap matters. What if the state faced an emergency and we needed to hire people when there's an arbitrary cap on state employment that prevents us from responding appropriately? So we believe it's unnecessary and arbitrary. Three, I heard and appreciated Representative Smith's comments about a merger of PEB and OEB, but for the record, we oppose a merger. We'll provide testimony about why, but we don't think it will save money, and we don't believe the systems are similar. Four, we oppose putting the 3.4% cap into statute. PEB has met this cap every year since it was adopted as a legislative mandate in 2011, and the board just made changes to stay within that cap again this year. We feel like a statutory limit does not account for the variation that may be necessary for a health care plan, and that it puts PEB in a bad negotiating position with providers. We're going to provide testimony that will go into more detail on some of these items. In closing, we know that the legislature is trying to figure out complicated problems, but please don't underestimate how these conversations you're having here make employees feel. This session has been hard for state and other public workers. People in general are feeling undervalued. Just like any business, if the state wants to keep quality employees, they must work at it especially in an economy with a 4.5% unemployment rate. We hope that you will take that into account during all these conversations. Thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity, Co-Chair Halvey, Co-Chair Gerald, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sasha Sergeyeva, and I'm a casework investigating child abuse for DHS Child Welfare, and I'm a member of SEIU 503. I'm here to testify in the opposition of the Bill 1067 as it's currently written. Child welfare already struggles to retain and recruit staff. We are currently staffed approximately at 66.6%. We have a lot of vacant positions we can't fill. We don't have enough people to provide transportations, visitations, and supervision during visitations between children and their parents. In April, in Multnomah County, we had 70 children on a wait list waiting for the visitations. Amount of the referrals coming for the investigations have been increasing, but the number of CPS workers, people who investigate child abuse like myself, have been decreasing drastically. The turnover rate is extremely high in child welfare. The official number is 23%. It means 23% of workers leave every year. There are a lot of reasons for this. The work is very challenging, stressful, and heartbreaking. We are investigators, social workers, and lawyers all at once. The pay is extremely low for what we are asked to do. And the constant stream of stories about public employees and discussions in this building about reducing our health benefits and our retirement benefits will just add to the problem of retention and recruitment of in child welfare. It feels like sometimes that legislator looks at us as a line item on a budget document, but we are actually real people who do a really hard job. And I would like to give you a little bit of a glimpse of what my day looks like. Most of the days I spend in the field, I interview children, families. I hear stories about domestic violence, physical abuse, sexual abuse. Imagine what it's like to hear stories from children who are telling you that someone put something inside of their private parts. I go to homes where I see little kids roaming around. The houses are filthy, and parents are struggling with addictions. Very often, we get yelled, called names, we're threatened. Sometimes we call the police, and we go and wait in the car, fearing for our lives. Because the only protection I have is a pen and a notepad. We make plans with families and community partners to help families to alleviate their life circumstances. We do all of these things at once, and sometimes we have to write a court report, arrange visitations, transportations, and transport children. Some of my peers, they stay in the hotel with kids overnight where they don't sleep because we don't have foster homes. Nor we have enough certifiers to actually recruit and support existing foster families. And those people, they go back to work and most likely work a 12-hour day because there is not enough time in the day to finish the job. So in my office, on average, we receive 250 referrals to investigate. And those referrals, it's immediate response. It means we have to respond within 24 hours. Right now, we just have 17 CPS workers. So if everyone is in the office, we still get a lot of referrals a day. Sometimes we get each a new case every day, or two cases, three cases a day to go out. I would like for you just to be mindful that decisions you make right now can have a huge impact on workforce and child welfare. It's already so difficult to recruit and retain staff, and will be even harder to retain and recruit staff, and families and children will suffer the most. And we serve all the families, wealthy families and families living in poverty, because abuse happens everywhere. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Co-Chair Gerard and Co-Chair Holvey and the respected members of the committee. My name is Daniel Smith. I'm a doctor of psychology, and I work at the Oregon State Hospital. I've been there for 14 years, and I'm a proud member of SEIU. I'm here today to testify in opposition to portions of SB 1067. And part of the reason that I'm doing that is I'm concerned about potentially unintended consequences. One of the major issues facing the hospital is hiring quality professional staff to meet the needs of our residents. In the last couple of years,
The majority of psychologists that have been hired have been hired at the top of the salary range so that they would be willing to either relocate to Oregon or to work for the state system. Potential changes to our retirements, to our benefits, and our salaries is going to continue to affect people's willingness to come to work for the state. One of my concerns is that if you slow down the hiring process, that a process that now may take 3, 6, or more months will be extended even further. And I would point out that the search for an appropriate superintendent for the hospital is now going into its second or third year without any success to find somebody to replace our current superintendent. As you all know, the state hospital is a 24/7, 365-day operation. When we don't have people there to do the work because there's a vacancy, because a position has not been filled, the work still has to be done because we can't let our clients, our residents, go without services. What happens at that time then is that the state pays overtime for those people that are working. And those men and women are at higher risk of being injured because they're working longer days. They're overtired. And if that happens on a consistent basis, it gets to be even more of a problem. I have great respect for the work that you've done. I'm very hopeful about cost containment in the state of Oregon. But please consider the unintended consequences of some of the things that you're contemplating at this time. I want to thank you for listening to my testimony.
Any comments or questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair, may I just want to say thank you for being in the field. Really appreciate that. Thanks for testifying. And I do think, you know, when we had the capital, cost containment group here earlier in the year, there was this conversation about how you would handle vacancies and hiring. It is complicated. We want to make sure we get it right. So thank you very much.
Okay. Melissa?
Thank you, co-chairs, committee members. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm the political director of SEIU Local 503. I'm going to spend my time talking about the PEB-OEB merger that's proposed in this bill. We believe there's been lots of conversation and some misinformation about the employee health care benefits throughout this session. And so first, we want to talk a little bit about PEB, but then also why we oppose the eventual merger of PEB and OEB. We want to be clear, PEB is a very good benefit. SEIU members and other state employees have consistently chosen to prioritize funding for their health care benefits as the number one priority in order to maintain high quality and affordable health care for themselves and their families. The priority can be seen by the fact that a recent DAS survey found that state workers make 98% of total compensation of their private sector peers. But if you just look at salary, it's 88%. And that's because they have prioritized those quality benefits over their salaries. In 2010, PEB switched from a fully insured model to a self-insured model for its largest plans. Moving to self-insurance has saved PEB about $180 million since 2010, according to PEB staff, and has allowed for sustainable increase in healthcare costs. Also in 2011, PEB made a number of major changes in the way we insure ourselves in order to reduce cost growth, while also improving employee health and the quality of care. These changes were effective with the 2012 plan year, including the health engagement model, which was meant to encourage members to maintain better health care behaviors and habits, starting employee premium shares, and adopting a number of plan design changes, some of which were evidence-based changes intended to steer employees to lower cost treatment alternatives and to eliminate barriers to more cost-effective care options, and some which shifted cost to employees. The changes have worked. Since 2011, the average rate increase has dropped dramatically. The average annual increase, we've been able to stay below that 3.4% cap since 2011. And in addition, before that, in contrast, just to give a sense, annual increases in PED premium rates from 2001 to 2011 were 10.5%, more than five times higher than the annual rate since 2011. And, you know, to put even a clearer point on it, PEB's ability to save resources even allowed the state to redirect $120 million from PEB reserves for the 2015-17 budget year. So they actually were able to take $120 million out of PEB reserves to come fund the state budget in 2015-17 because of the ability for them to save money since 2011. Estimates for the cost increases were that PEB would be over the 3.4% cap for the 2018 plan year. In order to get the cost down, the PEB board worked together, actually, to make the plan design changes and worked with providers to get costs down. And so just based on the decisions made by the PEB board last week, the composite rate for PEB is now estimated to be 3.2% for the 2018 plan year, making sure that they meet that cap. So even though we've continued to meet this cap and worked hard as a PEB board to meet the cap, we don't believe that it should be in statute as proposed in this bill. We think that there could be unforeseen circumstances that make it impossible to meet the cap, especially with the unknowns at the federal government and how that will impact demand and providers, how that will impact providers. We think putting the cap in statute also does not give PEB the full ability to bargain effectively, and that could put it in a bad bargaining position. And we also just believe fundamentally that micromanaging the PEB board will not lead to success with negotiations with plans. Our bigger concern, though, is with the OWEB and PEB merger that is proposed in the bill. We appreciate that there's time to study it, and we appreciate that there's going to be a plan put together. And so that is a good part about it. But we do the reason that we have some concerns is we just believe that PEB and OWEB are fundamentally different plans. PEB is a statewide plan, just a couple options for members. The PEB board actually manages plans and can control costs through plan design changes. And that's just different for the OWEB board. They are really offering different plans to different school districts. In addition, PEB is self-insured and OWEB is not. As I mentioned earlier, being self-insured has saved PEB $180 million since becoming self-insured. And so would it make sense and does it make sense to merge a system that's self-insured and not self-insured? Our boards are structured very differently, and they do very different things because they're structured differently. And finally, if the goal here is to reduce benefits, which I do think is part of the goal in some of these conversations, and I don't think it's the end goal of the OWEB-PEB merger, but I think it's just been part of the goal and part of the conversation previously that we heard people testify to, it's just hard to imagine how that saves money. As I mentioned, we are at 98% in total compensation of the private sector peers, according to the DAS study this year. If the state wants to remain competitive as a competitive employer, cutting benefits necessarily shouldn't save money because they're going to have to put that money back into salary to stay competitive with their private sector peers. And so I think that the focus on benefits this session has continued to assume that if you cut benefits, it doesn't matter on the salary side. But if we really are right now at the state of competitiveness with our private sector peers, we do believe that money will just have to be shifted to remain a competitive employer. And as I've said multiple times this session, I just don't think that the goal should be to make the state an employer of last resort. And I think that is something that is very important. So unfortunately, I was not able to see the documents that the Oregon Business Council referred to yet online, but I think we will probably have some response to some of the ideas that they suggested in their amendments for the bill as well. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify about that specific portion of the bill.
Any comments or questions? Thanks so much. Okay, we got three more to pass down here. Joe from AFSCME, John from OEA, and Tyler from OSEA. Please proceed, whoever wants to go first.
Chair Gerard, Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Joe Basler. I work for Oregon AFSCME. I'm their political director. I don't have a lot to add. I feel like most of it's been said, and it is Friday afternoon. But I would just sort of echo, there are some great parts of this bill. We think sections 29 through 34. We testified when it was the House bill earlier in support. I think the debt collection portion that Representative Gomberg has worked on is really important and a huge thing we've been missing for a lot of years. And also looking deep into the procurement process, something we at AFSCME have been wanting for a long time, not just at the state level, but also at local level, too. But I do think we're one of the few organizations that has members in both PEB and OWEB. We have a very few members in OWEB, but it has been a significant savings, especially the local governments, when they were able to shift over to OWEB. Josephine County, for instance, when they moved over to OWEB, it was my president even said it was like a $300 a month raise because there was such a reduction in what their premiums were. So, but they're very different systems. They have very different employers. Having two employers, the university system and the state, is a very different sets up a very different dynamic than having over 200 employers like OWEB manages. So, that's a very this bill doesn't flip a switch and merge them. It would be a process, but it's something that we're very concerned about. But that's all I have.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, members of the committee, my name is John Larson. I'm a high school English teacher from Hermiston, Oregon, and I also serve as vice president and president-elect of the Oregon Education Association. I represent 44,000 professional educators across the state. We respectfully offer our opposition to Senate Bill 1067. We appreciate the goal of trimming public sector costs, but we feel that the trend, this bill has too many pieces of it that continue the trend of targeting public educators and the benefits of public employees. We feel like it does not address the true cost drivers in the healthcare, like outsized hospital executive compensation and runaway pharmaceutical costs. Also, the legislature has not yet taken any action to remedy the primary factor in Oregon's budget shortfalls, Oregon's low corporate tax revenue, and our perpetual status among the bottom of the barrel for corporate taxes. Much of our opposition is around the merger of OEB and PEB as well, and has been said already. Part of the problem is that PEB is self-insured and OEB is not. In order for OEB to be self-insured, there would have to be a large capital outlay, and that is not part of this bill as well. And so there's some problems there. The board makeup is definitely different. We also had some concerns around the Representative Huffman talked about the rural hospitals and access of our members, especially in the rural areas of the state, to hospitals given the 200% of Medicare. So we appreciate the effort to reduce the costs, but at this point we would have to oppose this bill.
Just for the record, if you drove away more than 100 miles, make sure you check the box.
I actually am on full-time release from Hermiston right now, so I did not drive that far.
Okay. Thank you so much. Can you go ahead?
Co-chairs Gerard and Holvey, my name is Tyler Shipman. I am a government relations specialist with the Oregon School Employees Association. My association represents over 21,000 educational support employees and paraprofessionals. I'm here today in opposition of Senate Bill 1067. I'll try to be brief. I think most of the comments I have already been made by the panels before me. Most specifically, I'd just like to talk about Sections 27 and 28, which set a cap of 3.4% on the annual increase in premium amounts. This is something that OEB has typically been able to make, and we're very concerned about putting this into statute that if there were large price hikes that we were unforeseen or unable to account for, the only remedy is really for the board to do would be to increase copays or decrease the quality of health benefits that are actually offered to employees. This, of course, too, is very significantly hits educational employees who, through collective bargaining, as it stands right now, most districts have already negotiated and set contribution limits and caps to the amount of insurance that's paid. So currently, we already have a large group of employees that are already contributing to their insurance. More significantly, too, we have part-time members that are actually below benefit levels but have negotiated a provision in the collective bargaining agreement where they pay for the full premium. Any kind of change or cost shift to the employee through this would be extremely detrimental to them and their ability to actually afford insurance and be able to get those health benefits. Thank you.
Any questions for this panel?
Ask a hypothetical. Because I got all three of these people up here. Let's say you change the tax system and you had a significant higher contribution on the corporate side. And if it's the current types that we are considering, they actually historically increase at a slower level than does personal income taxes. Only 2 or 3% slower, but it's just the makeup of the taxes that they tend to increase. So let's be optimistic and let's say you could count on an 8% annual growth or biennial growth in revenue. How would you contain the costs of government within that annual growth in revenue or biennial growth in revenue? I mean, 3.4% per year is quite close to 4% per year, and our biennial revenue growth, even if we add this, might be around probably, we could count on maybe about 8%.
Chairs Girard, Chairs Holvey, Senator Devlin, I mean, I think we actually have, our board member on PEB and our former board member on OWEB, we've actually pushed to keep that 3.4% increase and trying to maintain, do everything we can to maintain it. I think that our concern is putting it statutorily and then not being able to, as my colleagues have mentioned, be able to adapt to an unforeseen circumstance. But it's kind of my best answer. It's kind of avoiding the answer, sorry.
Any follow-ups or any more questions?
If I may, real quick.
Sure.
Just to be clear, too, with the increase that you're talking about, sorry, Senator or Co-Chairs Girard and Holvey, Senator Devlin, what I think the biggest problem, too, with this, with the OEB and putting in a statute, is it would force the OEB board, too, to make these changes, reductions in benefits, increased copay, without actually being able to make those changes in the OEB plans that would then go to districts, which would allow our actual members to bargain any changes that might be put forward.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Anybody else wish to testify on 1067? Any comments from
Mr. Chair? If I could just for the record and for folks watching, the challenge I think of Senate Bill 1067 is, I think we're all committed to cost containment. I think you've heard from the testimony, no matter what side of the issue you're on, the challenge of putting these kinds of things in statute, the challenge of, you know, trying to get to that while also being, you know, the flexibility that comes with not overprescribing how we budget, as someone who works in, you know, as the co-chair would probably say, some flexibility is warranted. So I think what we're going to try to achieve in this bill is to be very clear that we are resetting the course of how we do business in an efficient and effective way, but try to avoid unintended consequences. So I think that's the challenge for all of us when we try to finalize this bill.
Yes. For the good of order, anybody else? We're